It's my great pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to introduce Dr. Katie Hopkins, who works at the Antimicrobial Resistance and Healthcare Associated Infection Laboratory at the Health Protection Agency, who's now going to talk about the laboratory diagnosis of infections due to these problematic gram-negatives. Katie?
Okay, thank you, David. So I'd just like to take this opportunity for thanking the conference organisers for inviting me to speak today. So as we've already heard, the emergence of multi-drug resistant gram-negative infections is a serious threat to antimicrobial therapy, in particular resistance to beta-lactams, and probably resistance to carbapenems is one of the most important current issues in antimicrobial resistance at the moment. Because this is limiting our treatment options, the prompt detection of these organisms is essential, not only obviously to help guide patient treatment, but also for implementation of infection prevention and control procedures, particularly as we heard that many of these resistance mechanisms are plasmid-borne, so they have the potential for the high rate of transmissibility. However, detection of these organisms can be a challenge for the diagnostic lab because there are a few standardized methods, and also diverse resistance mechanisms can encode resistance to the same class of antibiotic. So one of the first stages in identification of any gram-negative multi-drug-resistant organism after bacterial identification is antibiotic susceptibility testing, and this can be done by either quantitative, qualitative, or automated methods. And then some criteria apply to that data so you can interpret it to determine the likelihood of therapeutic success. However, you can get additional information from antimicrobial susceptibility data by applying interpretative reading. So this requires you to look at the entire antibiotic susceptibility pattern rather than just results for the individual antibiotics. And this can mean that you can infer the resistance mechanisms. It helps you recognize grossly unusual resistance phenotypes, and this is usually as a result of either a problem with the bacterial identification or within the susceptibility testing. So these should be repeated and then, if confirmed, followed up. And you can also edit the susceptibilities as appropriate. So if you apply knowledge of intrinsic bacterial resistance and the resistance phenotype that is applied by the inferred resistance mechanism, then you can edit your susceptibilities based on that. And it also helps identify further drugs to test. So by applying interpretative reading, you can do some sort of tentative surveillance of resistance mechanisms. Now, to apply interpretative reading, you need to have your bacterial isolates identified to ideally a species level, and also they need to be tested against large batteries of different antibiotics. So in the reference lab, we test for about 30 different antibiotics and or inhibitor combinations. But even then, it's not an exact science. Multiple mechanisms within the same bug can mean that you can get confusing and misleading patterns, and there are always exceptions and anomalies. So just when you think you've got the hang of interpretative reading, nature goes and throws you a curveball, and you're left scratching your head again as to what's going on. So this is illustrated quite nicely by the problem with spotting carbapenemase producers. As we've heard, carbapenem resistance can be caused either by isolates producing a carbapenemase enzyme or isolates that have an ESBL or AMPC enzyme with some impermeability issues. And as this schematic shows here, the MIC distributions for carbapenems for organisms with these two resistance mechanisms can overlap, and it's very difficult to tell whether this is due to a carbapenemase producer or an isolate with an ESBL or AMPC with porin loss. So really, if you have a high index of suspicion, then you should be performing supplemental tests on these isolates and or sending them to the reference lab. So supplemental tests to confirm resistance can either consist of disc-based or gradient strip-based methods, and these can also use inhibitor substrates to help identify the resistance mechanism behind them. However, though these are quite cheap and cheerful methods, they can suffer problems with specificity and sensitivity, and there can also be a problem if there's more than one resistance mechanism present in the bug, and also if the resistance mechanism is expressed at quite a low level. Also, these tests are dependent on bacterial growth, so you're further delaying confirmation of resistance by another 24 to 48 hours, which obviously potentially delays appropriate antibiotic treatment for your patient and also implementation of infection and control procedures. But you can decrease the time it takes to confirm, in particular, carbapenemase activity by applying something like this colorimetric assay that was recently published. So this is based on detection of hydrolysis of the beta-lactam ring, and this results in a change in pH, which is detected by a pH-sensitive indicator. In this particular example, they've also used the inhibitors tazobactam and EDTA. So this allows you to be able to differentiate between the different classes of carbapenemase. Unlike the previous phenotypic tests I showed you, this assay is not dependent on bacterial growth, so you've not got that extra 24 to 48 hours growth period. And you can use growth directly from either your antibiotic susceptibility testing plate or from screening media. So the authors claim that you can get a result within 3 hours. The inventors of this assay say that it has 100% specificity and sensitivity, though there can be difficulty if there is more than one carbapenemase present. And in the reference lab, we'll be performing our own evaluation of this test, because as we can see from the figure here, there isn't really a sort of clear differentiation between a positive and negative result, so we want to have a look at this ourselves. Many of you may be familiar with the use of MALDI-TOF mass spectrometry for the precise and rapid bacterial identification in the diagnostic lab, but more recently it's been applied for detection of beta-lactam resistance and in particular carbapenemase production. Now, the enzymes that are responsible for antibiotic resistance are usually not encoded at a high enough level that you can detect them in the usual protein spectrum, but by modifying the MALDI-TOF protocol slightly, you can detect these resistance mechanisms. So as we can see here, if you run just a solution of meropenem on the MALDI-TOF, you get this peak here at 385 Daltons. And then if you inhibit the meropenem solution in the presence of a carbapenemase producer, you get these two further peaks at 385 and 380. So that shows you the antibiotic metabolites. This has had good evaluations for detection of carbapenem resistance, but it can also be used for detection of other beta-lactams if you use beta-lactamases, if you use appropriate beta-lactam antibiotics with inhibitors. And it also has the potential for detection of other resistance mechanisms as long as metabolism of the target antibiotic occurs and there's a big enough gap between the antibiotic and the metabolite. It's been shown to have no false positives or false negatives by the various studies that have been performed on it. And again, this is something that we're going to be looking at in the reference lab. Now, PCR has been used quite a lot over the years for detection of resistance determinants, and although the detection of the precise resistance determinant is not necessary for patient treatment, it does help with tracing of particular resistant isolates within the healthcare setting or the community, and also the spread of resistance genes within different organisms. PCR has high specificity and sensitivity, and it usually gives results within 4 to 6 hours. There are also assays that are being developed that allow you to detect particular resistant clones. So, like this assay here that can be used. This assay here that's been used for detection of the KPC ST258 clone. And at the moment, unfortunately, there are very few commercial assays that are focusing on the gram-negatives, but the Czech MDR system relies on real-time PCR to give a simple yes or no answer for presence of either the common ESBL genes or for the common carbapenemase genes. These high-plex assays are another commercial assay that's available, and these rely on PCR followed by an ELISA-type reaction for detection of either the carbapenemase genes or ESBLs. And they identify genes within 2.5 to 4 hours, depending on whether you isolate your DNA directly from the clinical specimen or whether you isolate from purified bacterial growth. And this table here shows the evaluation recently performed by Kayser and colleagues. And they found that the assays have good sensitivity and specificity for most of the carbapenemase genes, so for KPCs, VIMs, NDMs, and OXA48 genes. But the assay was not able to detect the three IMP producers that they had in their panel. And this is probably because the IMP family of genes is quite diverse. So there seems to be maybe some issue with detection here. And so, again, I think these assays need more evaluation. So the problem with PCR really, as just shown by the previous assay, is that you can be quite limited by the number of targets that you can amplify and detect within one assay. But this can be overcome by using microarrays. So these are a more cost-effective way of detecting your targets. These can detect 100 or more targets per test. So this allows the potential for not only bacterial species identification, but also concurrent identification of resistance genes, virulence genes, and then also epidemicity predictors and strain-specific markers. So these can help you detect and track the spread of outbreak-related strains. In the reference lab at the moment, we're in the process of moving over from using conventional PCR to these Czech MDR arrays for our detection of carbapenemase genes. And the array that we use in the reference lab also enables us to detect the different groups of CTXM ESBLs and also detection of the most clinically common TEM and SHV ESBLs. But there is a further iteration of these arrays that also allows you to detect the plasmid AMPC genes as well. So these assays take approximately 6 hours to perform, but that's not including the time it takes you for DNA extraction. But they have had positive evaluations in a number of countries, including the UK. And the table here shows you the results that we had from the reference lab when we performed our evaluation. And you can see that we had no false negatives for detection of the carbapenemase genes. There was one false positive detection of a VIM gene, but this was not detected when the array was repeated, and it was not confirmed by PCR as well. And as you would expect, the assay was able to easily differentiate between a carbapenemase producer and isolates that have an AMPC or ESBL with porin loss. So at the moment, we're seeing a lot of improvement in next-generation sequencing equipment, and the sequencing platforms are becoming a lot easier to use, a lot more user-friendly. And I think in the near future, it's likely that performing next-generation sequencing is going to be as easy as performing a PCR. This has the advantage of being able to, again, perform bacterial identification, but also get information on the bacterial virulence genes and on antibiotic resistance traits, and also, again, allow you to trace the spread of strains for outbreak investigation. I think the information that we can gain from next-generation sequencing as well will enable us to identify targets for maybe new vaccines and for new diagnostic tests, and also maybe inform us on how antibiotic resistance can develop during the course of patient treatment, so maybe enable us to develop antibiotics that may be able to circumvent this. And I think the equipment's probably going to become quite commonplace in diagnostics in the near future. It's likely that we'll see more commercially available kits for enabling you to perform next-generation sequencing. And this is just one example that's produced by a company called Pathogenica. And it uses next-generation sequencing to detect and type the 12 most common healthcare-associated pathogens. So this accounts for more than 90% of organisms that cause healthcare-associated infections. And the way the kit works is that within one sample, you should be able to detect those 12 different organisms as well as detecting common resistance genes. The data is automatically analysed by software that is provided by the company, and it outputs a report that produces clinically relevant data. So the kit should give you extraction to result in less than 12 hours. So molecular tests are rapid. They allow faster establishment of appropriate antibiotic therapy and implementation of infection control procedures. And they also enable you to confirm the precise resistance mechanisms. So they can be useful for sorting out ambiguous phenotypic results. They can be good for detection of low-level resistance or the resistance mechanisms that encode low-level resistance, and they can inform local epidemiology. And they also have the potential for automation. So you might be forgiven for wondering, well, is there actually going to be any future for phenotypic antimicrobial susceptibility testing? Well, yes, because there's an inherent problem with molecular detection. The molecular methods are only as good as the available sequence data that you use to develop them. So you may be able to only detect resistant isolates with known genes or new variants of resistance genes if there's sufficient homology. So it's not possible to base a treatment on a negative molecular result. Conversely, detection doesn't necessarily accurately predict therapeutic failure because a resistance gene may be present but not expressed, or there may be just a partial copy of the gene, which obviously was not going to be expressed either. So susceptibility must always be confirmed for guidance of antibiotic treatment. And I think it's, at the moment at least, molecular methods may never replace cheap phenotypic methods. I think they're more likely to be used in collaboration with the phenotypic methods. So just to summarise, multi-drug resistant gram negatives present an increasing threat to antibiotic therapy, and although interpretative reading can help infer the major resistance mechanisms if the bug is expressed in a classical phenotype, as the bugs become more complex and they acquire more resistance mechanisms, this is becoming more difficult. There are phenotypic and genotypic assays being developed that decrease the time it takes to confirm resistance, and these are beginning to be developed using platforms that are more user-friendly and more available to diagnostic labs, such as the MALDI-TOF and commercial real-time PCR. And these are likely to be sort of machines that you can have in your lab that have more than one purpose, so your lab's not going to become cluttered with lots of different machines for different assays. So I think we're going to be able to see confirmation of resistance by the diagnostic lab rather than the reference lab in the near future. But as I've said earlier, confirmation of susceptibility must remain the prime criterion for antibiotic therapy. Thank you.
Thanks indeed, Katie. Questions from the floor? Yes, sir.
Hi. The University of South Carolina. Fantastic presentation. I have one question. I view the reference lab as being an essential tool in helping us understand how these microbes are moving through our patient populations. Do you think the reference lab with these new molecular tools will be able to provide us insight into how and why these organisms are able to maintain themselves chronically in a population in the absence of the antibiotic selective pressure that we think are, you know, keeping them in the clinical system?
Okay, so we have started in the reference lab using next-generation sequencing to look at resistance plasmids and resistant organisms, and sort of by having information on the plasmids, it may give us some sort of pointers as to how these plasmids are spreading. Also, the whole genome sequencing of the organisms that are carrying them, hopefully that will give us kind of pointers as to, as the first slide I showed on next generation sequencing, why these strains have the sort of propensity to be able to spread, whether there's any difference in sort of bacterial fitness encoded by the plasmids, that sort of thing. So I think with next generation sequencing, it should be able to kind of give us some pointers onto why these bugs are so successful.
Any more questions from the floor? Maybe I can ask you one thing, Katie. You've given an eloquent presentation on various high-tech methodology, but back in St. Elsewhere's, of course, commonly an isolate is tested with six discs. It's not tested with a carbapenem unless it's resistant to most or all of those first six discs. Do you think, for example, we miss a lot of OXA48 producers which may appear cephalosporin susceptible? Are we living in a fool's paradise? Is there a lot more trouble than we're actually recognising?
Yes, I would imagine that could be quite possible. I mean, it is quite difficult to spot, for example, the OXA48 producers that you've just mentioned, even when we do test against 30 antibiotics and inhibitors. So, yes, it could be a problem.
Okay. Anything else from the floor? Well, thanks indeed, Katie, and I'll hand back now to Peter to introduce the next speaker.